Take it away.
Okay, just let me say hello to everyone. Welcome. We're glad to have you for our February workforce development affinity call, affinity group call. I think I have seen most of you, but again, my name is Amy Mazur and I'm coming from Boston. And I'm really pleased to introduce our presenter for today. I'm going to give you a little bit of background for Michelle, and we're going to do the typical, the typical program or protocol where she'll present some good information. We'll have a chance to interact with that information, questions, and engage with all of you. And I'm really excited to have Michelle. So let me think about, I think that's probably the logistics we need. Obviously, if you have questions, put them in the chat room. We'll be monitoring that, and we'll go till 2:15 today. So Michelle Martin is the Senior Associate with the New Start Career Network at the John J. Heldrich Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University. And she has over 20 years of experience in career and workforce development and human resources, and has worked with numerous state and local workforce agencies to help them develop and implement innovative, effective workforce programs. Using design thinking, entrepreneurial approaches, and a focus on innovation, she works with clients to identify opportunities and creates value in ways that go beyond the usual government-funded programming. She is coordinating that New Start Career Network, which is a workforce program serving New Jersey residents over age 45 who've been out of work for 6 months or over. And she's providing ongoing training and support for volunteer career coaches and provides virtual and in-person career services to their job seekers. She does many more things, and we're really happy to have her. And typically when I introduce people, what I like to do is give their bio, but also say a little bit of, give a little personal note to the introduction. I have had the great fortune of working with Michelle over a number of years. She is really cutting edge on the work that she's going to be describing today. We are really lucky to have her. I've wanted to bring her into this program to introduce those of you who don't know about her work, to have the opportunity to hear her work. She takes this to a different level, I think, and keeps people thinking deeply and in a very engaging way about what we do need to think about to help our clients in the most effective way. So welcome, Michelle.
Thank you, Amy.
I'm happy to have you.
Thank you. That I feel like you set those expectations really high, and I'm bound to fail them. So, you know, it's always better to under talk about me, and then they can be like, oh, wow, she was much better than I expected. I can only go down. So thank you for inviting me to, you know, join this group and sort of talk about some of the work that we've been doing and some of the questions that we're asking ourselves and learning from the work. I just want to kind of talk a little bit more about two projects that I've been working on that are sort of the backdrop for some of the ideas and things that I'm going to share today. As Amy mentioned, the first one is the New Start Career Network, which is a program that I got involved with when it first launched in 2015, where we are working with long-term unemployed New Jersey residents over age 45. This is a different group than we usually end up seeing in most workforce programming, in that most of our job seekers have at least a bachelor's degree. 25% of them have graduate degrees. We're talking MBAs and other kinds of graduate degrees. They have long work histories, many of them with, you know, 20, 30 years of experience, often at the same company. And they are just don't fit into, you know, the usual parameters of what a lot of us think of when we think about people who need retraining or training in order to access work and so forth. And I say that because I think that we've often tended to think, well, these people don't have problems finding jobs, or why are they having problems finding jobs? And I want to put out there that one of the things we're clearly seeing is that age and is an issue, but education certainly is not. And there are lots of other things going on that are making us really think differently about how do we support job seekers. The other thing I want to say about New Start is that we also have the opportunity to work with volunteer coaches. So we have individuals from throughout New Jersey who volunteer to work with our members, and they provide both ongoing coaching to folks who request it and also laser coaching on things like, you know, working on their resume or LinkedIn and that kind of thing. So I have an opportunity to interact both directly with job seekers as well as with our coaches and providing training and support for coaches. So I'm getting to see lots of different perspectives and angles on what's happening in the search. The other program or the other project that I'm involved with now, which started about 15 months ago, is New Jersey is working on creating something they're calling the New Jersey Career Network, which is where we're looking at how can we use digital tools to better support the 96% of New Jersey residents who do not go into a one-stop career center to receive services. And we want to expand supports and everything else for the residents who are either, right now we're focusing on people who are trying to get back to work. So they do have some degree of work history and that kind of thing. But we're really looking at how can we use these digital tools and so forth to support them. And that has us really deeply involved in interviewing and talking with job seekers about their approach to their job search. How are they thinking about what is considered productive activity and unproductive activity? How are they managing their moods and their motivation and all of that stuff? Because we're doing really intensive user interviews with folks to really kind of get a picture for what's happening in their search. And so that's another piece of work that's really had us questioning how do we provide support for people. Now, I need to update my bio, Amy, because I've actually been doing this work 25 years at this point. And I think that one of the things that has become clear to me is that in many ways we operate in workforce with sort of a medical model or approach to what we're doing. We first of all look to diagnose what's wrong. We use assessments often to figure out what are the barriers that people are facing, what's wrong with them, why are they not finding work, and so forth. Then we're looking at figuring out some kind of treatment plan. And we're putting to people, this is essentially your problem, this is how we can fix this problem. And typically the main things that we're providing, in addition to whatever supportive services we might provide, is information and advice. And we're often thinking about how do we give people more information, because clearly they're not doing this because they need more information. How do we give them better information? Maybe the quality of information isn't great. We've even been looking at how do we give them just-in-time information so that they're only dealing with one thing at a time as they need it. But all of it is about how do we provide people with information and advice. And then, of course, the goal is to return to health, and that is go back to work. And our belief is if they comply with this treatment plan, then that will get them back to work. For me at least, this is something that I feel like I've seen over and over again as we think about and talk about how do we support folks, where it is essentially, you know, operating, as I say, from the sort of diagnosis, treatment, and then return to work kind of thing, that is informing our thinking, informing the ways that we engage with folks. That being said, we started to really look at what is happening with our job seekers and in their search. And so we start noticing that while advice and such can work for some people, that's a very small subset of folks. We often see that they will come to us, ask for advice, and then ignore our advice or argue with us about the advice that we are giving, or say that it didn't, you know, they've tried that and that didn't work. We see a lot of folks immediately getting stuck in bad job search habits, where they're addicted to online applications, they're addicted to transactional networking. They're doing things that actively work against them finding work, and it's very hard to break them out of those habits. We also were noticing that any learning that we did, I've done over 100 webinars, they'll watch it and then it doesn't stick. It doesn't seem to go anywhere. It doesn't seem to do anything. They'll say that's great information, but it doesn't change. We would ask job seekers in this research we were doing, tell us what you did yesterday. They could not tell us. They could not accurately represent the activities that had occurred the day before related to their job search. We also saw that there was a lot of difficulty in staying organized with things, keeping track of things. Many of our folks have a problem getting started on tasks, initiating tasks. They get overwhelmed or just are stuck in inertia. Also noticing people having a lot of difficulty managing their time, disappearing down black holes of internet tabs and reading about things and talking to people and so forth. And then all of a sudden their entire day was sucked up in other stuff. And also difficulty in adjusting their plans. They seem to be very, like, I have a plan, this is what I'm doing. They'll work it till the wheels fall off. And anything that might throw them off, they really experience as this major challenge to work with. So we're noticing all of these things happening with job seekers, but then also noticing what was happening with job seekers working with coaches. So people missing appointments. I'm desperate for coaching. I want to work with this coach. And then they miss appointments. They get emails from their coach saying, hey, we agreed to these things in the last session. And then they don't respond to those emails. They don't answer those emails. It's like they disappeared. They don't follow through on the tasks. They say that they've agreed to do something, and then the next time that we meet, they still haven't done it. I have job seekers who worked literally for 6 months on revising a resume because they were not following through on tasks. And again, I'm talking about people with bachelor's and master's degrees. This is not an educational issue. Also noticing that, you know, people would give up very easily. One of the things that New Start offers access to is JobScan, which is a tool that lets you copy and paste a job posting and compare it to your resume. What I see is people getting that, finding out that they have poor matches. They'll run a couple different job postings, have a poor match, and then that's it. They're done. They don't try to improve it. They don't try to change their job targets or anything. It's like, oh, I got bad news. I'm out of here. Also getting very stuck in negative stories. Our folks are convinced everything is about age discrimination, and it's really hard to move some of them out of those kind of negative stories. And ultimately seeing a lot of folks who are just not learning from their search related to that issue of adapting and adjusting. They're not paying attention to what's working, what's not working. How do I, you know, use this information in order to change my targets or my strategies or whatever? It just seems to, you know, they're stuck. They're doing the same things over and over again. So what this kind of got me thinking about was, well, I can give everybody the best information in the world. I can give them curated, here's the, you know, best way to do a LinkedIn kind of thing. But it's something's happening. And I used to think that it was simply a matter of if I give people the skill, you know, the information, build their skills, and they find the will, the motivation, then that's going to lead to them actually doing what it is that they need to do. But as I started to research it more and dig more deeply into it, I came across this work around executive function that talked about what they referred to as the curious disassociation between knowing something and actually doing something. And that there's a gap there. There's something that's happening, and we can provide all the help that we want in this skill and will area. But for a lot of people, something is happening here, and it doesn't translate into them actually doing things. So that sort of has led down a whole rabbit hole of needing to really look at what we're doing and how we're supporting people and what are the right kinds of supports. So for us, the key issues are, one, how are we orienting towards our job seekers? And I'm going to talk a little bit about, in particular, how we're handling coaching and how I'm trying to, some things that we need to shift around how we're doing coaching. I also want to talk a little bit about some brain-based stuff that we've been looking at, some stuff around trauma-informed and how trauma impacts job search and coaching, but also What's going on with executive function and how can we support executive function, which is key to people being able to implement on their goals. But I want to stop here and just kind of see, are there questions, comments? Can people relate to what I'm saying here?
And can I just also ask to follow up or just sort of build on what Michelle just said? I imagine that these are not surprises in terms of what she's saying about the job seekers and the coaches. So if people want to comment on that, I guess it's the same question, Michelle, but this isn't anybody surprised by that list. Those are things that I think I'll say personally, I'm not surprised by that list. It makes sense. Other people want to chime in?
This is Merrill in Metro West. Sounds like every one of our clients.
Yeah.
Gary, were you going to say something?
It sounds like all of our clients as well in Philadelphia.
Okay. So you're right on.
I'm on to something, right?
Yeah, whatever, you're on to something. Jennifer, yeah? Did you have something to say? Jennifer from Chicago?
Sorry, no, I agree.
We can't hear you.
I know. Can you hear me?
You can write it in the chat if you want. Okay. So I guess you can keep on going, Michelle.
Okay. So I'm happy to hear, well, not happy, but we're all experiencing the same kinds of things. I would say that I probably spent 3/4 of my working life knowing that this stuff was happening, but somehow thinking that if I just pushed harder, gave more information and so forth, that was going to really change things, was going to shift things. And I have to say that in the past couple of years, really being deeply, deeply embedded in both what's happening with the coaches and with the job seekers, I was forced to admit that I don't know what's going on and that I really needed to get a better handle on what are some other ways that we can more effectively support our job seekers. Also recognizing though that we're fighting against a culture that thinks that advice and information and so forth is the answer to lots of things. And some of the stuff that we're exploring and starting to think about moves us very much out of that realm and also is going to require us to really shift how we connect with people and how we think about working with people and what support actually looks like. So the first thing that we're really thinking about is what is our orientation towards job seekers? And we call the people, the volunteers that work with our job seekers in New Start, coaches, but what I find is that most of them want to come in as a consultant / trainer, where they are basically saying, you know, here's your problem, here are the answers to solve your problem, go do those things and see how that works. They may show people how to do things, but they're very focused on, I'm the expert, I'll give you the answers. If I'm not the expert on this particular thing, let me go find another expert to give you the answers. And it's a very directive kind of approach. And we're starting to really think about how are we going to keep people more focused on actually being coaches and facilitators, which means that the client is the expert. And we are making much better use of questions. One of the things that I talk to our coaches about is, you know, who's doing all the talking? If you're doing all the talking, then you're over here. You're being a consultant / trainer. You are not being a coach. Coaching is asking questions and sitting back and listening and hearing what people have to say and asking clarifying questions and summarizing and so forth. But if you're doing all the talking, then you're not coaching. And so that's kind of a first look at it. The other thing that we've been talking about related to that then is this sort of diagram, which I think is incredibly useful, that kind of shows us the different ways that we tend to engage with people. And I might add, this is how we often engage with colleagues as well. But if we're over here in the instruction, advice, opinion area, we're being much more directive. And actually what ends up happening is we remove people's autonomy and choice. And one of the things that we know and have been, we personally have been observing with job seekers, is what happens when you tell them what to do and you remove their autonomy. They spend, the only autonomy they have left is to say, no, I'm not doing that. And that's how you end up in arguments with people, because they are being directed to do things and it feels like they have no choice. And so argument and no becomes the choice. The other thing that we started to look at and understand is there's research that shows that when someone's identity is under threat, and in particular, when I think about our job seekers who have seen themselves as, you know, having status and identity from their work, they have worked some, they're workers, you know, they're directors of marketing, VPs of this, and so forth. Now they're not, and they don't even know where they fit into the society and the culture and everything else. And so their identity is under threat. That the research shows those people are actually less likely to take advice. They will nitpick the advice instead of taking it. And so we're having to look at, okay, how are we able to support folks in places where maybe we do need to offer information and advice without putting them into nitpicky mode? And this is a question that we're just starting to ask. We don't necessarily have answers, but I think we have to know what the questions are before we can start exploring answers. But this is a key thing that we see over and over and over again. The New Jersey Career Network tool that I mentioned previously, one of the things that we're doing is offering recommendations. You know, here are things that you can do to move your job search forward. And consistently what we are seeing is that they nitpick the recommendation. That recommendation isn't for me. I don't need that information. That information that you shared with me would work for someone else, but not for me. All of this, those you sent me to an article, and I don't understand why, you know, that's not on your website. They nitpick all aspects of it rather than just saying, hey, this is a good idea. Let me move forward with that. So it really makes us have to think again about what is this advice piece? And I think that the way that it is sort of summarized best for me is we have to also keep asking ourselves, are they coming to us for information or affirmation? Often they are saying they want information, but what I find in talking to people is they really want affirmation. You're okay. This is you're gonna, you know, be able to get through this. You're on the right track. Don't, you know, you don't have, like, don't let your anxiety, you know, get the best of you, whatever it is. But they're essentially wanting us to help them feel safe as opposed to giving them more advice. And honestly, what I see is if I engage with our job seekers on the question they ask, I need help with my resume, without first doing some affirmation, they will not listen to the information. I have had round after round after round of email exchanges with folks where I responded to them for their information request. They argue with me, they give me, you know, all kinds of feedback on why that wouldn't work for them and everything else. And then I'll go back and look at the thread and realize I did not affirm anything. I have to start with affirming, you're going to be okay, you're not alone, all of these things, and ask lots more questions. What have you tried so far? How have you been, you know, approaching this situation before? What has seemed to work for you? What hasn't seemed to work for you? The more I ask questions, the more they'll open up, the more they'll, you know, share, the more they come to their own realizations. But I have to tell you, it is hard, especially when they come at you and say that they want information. Our natural response is to give it to them. So that's a key thing. And I just want to stop there and just see if that resonates for folks and thinking about what is our role or what is our relationship with the people that we're working with.
So I unmuted everyone. If people are muted, then you have to unmute yourselves. But I'm sure people who are in the field could respond, but I thought that information versus affirmation was really something very interesting to think about.
And I'll add too that, you know, Michelle, when you talk about, you know, they have to feel safe, that whole piece about feeling heard and feeling seen and feeling safe is so critical to this process, and just ties right into affirmation. It won't go in. I mean, they have to feel like, I totally agree. And it's so tied to identity, like you were saying.
Yeah.
Because it's just not, if you don't affirm that identity, which they have had, it's not like it's, you know, it's just so critical, so critical. So thank you for mentioning that. Others?
Well, I am going to talk more about the safety piece of it in a second, because we're going to get into talking about the brain stuff and how our vagus nerve gets activated. And, you know, there's some major safety stuff we need to do.
Great. So Divya is saying something. Amy, you want to read that?
Yes. So Divya from Boston, colleague, says, yes, I agree. Many of my clients have low self-esteem because of their under or unemployed status. Affirmation is critical. Thank you, Divya.
I find it to be something I have to constantly remind myself of, though. It's like, yes, of course I know this. Of course I know I need to affirm people. Of course I know I need to help people, you know, feel better about themselves and their situation and all of that. But it can be really easy to forget that. And I have to keep it front and center for myself.
Why is it easy to forget that? Because you feel frustrated that they're not taking advice or they're not moving forward or all those other things that you...
Yeah. I think because so often the way that job seekers approach me, you know, on the phone or, you know, through email or whatever, is they say, I have some specific thing I need help with. I need help with my resume. I need help with my LinkedIn profile. I need help with, you know, network, whatever. My automatic response is to be like, okay, there's that problem. I know how to solve that problem. Here you go. There has to be a beat, right? Where it's like, okay, yes, there's that problem, but before I need to learn more about what are they really looking for? Because a lot of times they really aren't looking for help with their resume. What they're actually looking for is, I don't know what jobs I should be targeting in the first place. And so writing my resume is, you know, ridiculous because I don't even know what I should be doing. Or I'm feeling like I have no value, so writing my resume is an exercise in futility because I don't think I have anything to offer. I mean, there's something under it often.
Like you're a social worker.
Value. Yeah. Which, yep. I'm sorry, Lisa?
I said, I'm a social worker. It's like you're a social worker. You have to understand, they say one thing, but what are they really saying underneath? You
guys exactly. And then I'm busy.
And
you know, when I'm dealing with, I'm busy. I'm trying to help a lot of people. I have time constraints. There are lots of things that go on. It just becomes super easy to, there's a problem, let me get it off my to-do list.
Right.
I think, and I want to also add, and then we'll, Jay has a comment, but let me just add that, that it is, I do think that also to what you were saying, Michelle, a lot of us are, or the culture, it, like you were saying, it's so counter to stop because we want to be fixers. We want to, if, you know, people who are in this industry, you know, we want to help, we want to serve, we want to fix, we want to solve the problem. And so that's the default, as you said. And so this is about, like you said, taking a beat. Like it's actually, that's not solving the problem. We think we are, but we're really not. And it's really taking that step back and looking underneath. So
I'm saying, what is the value that we bring? I do a lot of work with one-stops, and they think that the value that they bring is the connection to a training program or the resume workshop or whatever. There certainly is some value in that. I'm not trying to say there isn't, but I think we have to question. I've had to really think about, how do I measure success? And sometimes the value that I bring is somebody leaves a conversation with me feeling more settled, more grounded, more able to think positively about the future. And they'll figure out the resume. Because honestly, there's tons of information online that, you know, a simple Google search will provide it to you. But for you to even be able to cross that gap between knowing and doing, there is something that has to happen emotionally, and I have to reorient myself to how am I really providing value? How am I, what does my help look like?
Yeah, that's huge. Jay asked the question from Los Angeles, what differences have you observed in job seekers in their 40s versus job seekers in their 60s?
Job seekers in their 60s are more worried that their best days are behind them, that they are irrelevant, that they have nothing to bring to the table, that people don't see them as being, you know, bringing any worth. And so they're a lot more concerned with age discrimination than job seekers in their 40s. And also just, you know, they're, like I say, they're more concerned about their relevance, in the market. And they're also, I find, more likely to be kind of beating themselves up over, you know, why didn't I get more training? Why did I stay in that job so long? I mean, looking at regrets. I mean, people in their 40s don't think they're old. People in their 60s do.
Jay, did you have any thoughts about that? Have you worked with people in their 60s versus people in their 40s? You're unmuted.
Not directly, but I know a lot of my colleagues here do, and I'm just trying to, you know, gather helpful information that I might share with them in dealing with that segment of the clientele we work with.
I also wanted to add that I think, you know, there is also an element of the bias that exists out there in the culture. So that piece comes into the individual who then takes on that burden when it's not theirs to take on. So there's that element too. You know, there's a taking on more than is yours to share, yours to take on around some of that. That feels like that's a piece of it too. And then what that does to your self-esteem, yeah.
Yeah, and we do talk to our job seekers about, you know, on the one hand, you obviously have to balance the reality of what goes on in the market. And all the research shows that there absolutely is age discrimination. It's a big problem. And there are lots of challenges with that. The other piece of it is, how much do I let that determine my choices? And so part of what I try to talk with our job seekers about is, you know, we can work on advocacy and changing bias and everything else, but that's a much longer term, you know, kind of thing. What we have to be thinking about is, you know, okay, who will value me? Who will think that what I bring to the table is, you know, important and can add value? Also, how can I talk about myself in terms of the ways that I add value? And how do I make sure that I'm not activating stereotypes? So just a really basic one, and I talk with our job seekers about this all the time. Of course, employers are worried that older people are not technologically savvy. That is one of the big stereotypes that's out there. When our job seekers use an AOL, a Yahoo, Hotmail, Netscape, that screams, I have not updated my use of technology. It's a simple thing. It's in some ways a stupid thing, but it is one of those things that trips that trigger that they don't know how to use technology and causes issues. I also have job seekers. I would say 80% of our job seekers have not recorded a personalized voicemail on their cell phone message. It is the computerized voice that answers the phone. That says you don't know how to use your phone. And so it's stuff like that we also talk about, where don't unnecessarily, you know, trip up or trigger these kinds of stereotypes. You don't have to do that. And just because, you know, I'm 56, I'll be 57 this year. I don't have to, you know, just sink into on that and, you know, oh, I'm too old to learn new stuff. And, you know, I can't figure that out. Like, those are not things I need to be doing. We all know somebody in their 60s who's, you know, like energetic and vibrant and tech savvy and everything else. And those are the kinds of things that, you know, we want to be embracing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll talk all day long about have lots of value. All right, so let me then talk a little bit about the brain stuff. So in my starting to really dig into what's going on with that curious disassociation between knowing and doing, there is a lot of updated brain research that helps us start to think differently about how we can support folks. And I want to quickly talk about the different functions of the brain, the different structures in the brain and how they operate. And then we're going to talk a little bit about how they factor into goal setting and achieving goals and so forth, because in the end, job search is about setting goals, persisting and following through on goals, achieving goals and so forth. So hey, we have the...
So good.
I'm sorry?
Yeah.
Oh, that, I think that was someone talking. Okay. So let me talk a little bit about the different structures. And what we have at the bottom is what's called our reptile brain, our survival brain, the brain that regulates our breathing, our heart rate, our digestion, our hunger, and so forth. All these things that we are born with that just sort of happen automatically. That is our lower brain. Then there's the limbic system, and that is the emotional brain, where it is registering emotion, it processing it, processing our memories and our responses to stress and so forth. And then we have the executive center, the thinking brain. When we think about thinking, when we think about planning, what we're really usually talking about is the executive brain, the executive function. This is the last to form, and it does not fully develop until we are age 25. I partially want to say that because in our youth programming, we are asking young people to have executive function skills that have not fully come on board. And so we have to be aware of the fact that part of what we're trying to do with young people is help them develop effective executive function. But we also want to keep in mind that stress and trauma impact our thinking brain. What actually happens is the reptile brain has these experiences that are not even things that we necessarily register immediately. It will leap up into our emotional center. What they've actually shown is that we will have emotional reactions and then explain them to ourselves. But they've happened out of conscious awareness. So I'll get angry with something, but I won't even realize that I'm angry. Or I'll have an explanation for anger, but it's really because I got triggered into fight, flight, or freeze. So we're going to talk more about that. But basically, kind of understanding that there are these three areas of the brain. And then if we're going to look at how we achieve goals, we have to understand that we start from the bottom and work up to executive function. So for in order for us to be able to do anything towards our goals, we first of all have to have a calm reptile brain. If we are in fight, flight, or freeze, we are not able to take in new information. We are not able to do anything other than survive and just kind of get through this moment or this series of moments. And that reptile brain is a key piece of this. And one of the first things we have to think about is the person activated? Are they in fight, flight, or freeze? Because if they are, it doesn't matter how much information we give. They're not taking it in. This is a key thing for us to keep an eye on. That if we're calm, if we're in flow, then we have to engage emotionally. So when we think about our goals, they need to be goals that where we feel emotionally connected to that goal. I have to feel like I really want it. So much of the goal setting we do is about things we don't want. And we have to think about, you know, how do we set goals in ways that are really deeply connected to things that people want. We also have to think about, is it something that makes a person want to move towards it or away from it? Because one of the things that we know on a very basic human level is we will avoid experiences that make us feel bad, and we will go towards experiences that feel good. That is, you know, emotion 101. And so we have to take that in, factor that into our thinking as we're helping people. Because as an example, I'm not going to go network if I'm scared to death of networking and haven't kind of processed all of that stuff, because going there ends up triggering all of my anxieties about my identity, my status. I start saying I don't belong here. There's all this stuff that happens, and then I'm not able to really function well. So that's the emotional part. And then we're looking at, you know, if we're engaged emotionally, if we're in a calm state, that's when we can then start to bring some executive function on board. And that's where we're really looking at, do I have the right planning skills? Do I have the self-control skills? Do I have the monitoring skills? And I'm going to show you a diagram that shows you the individual executive functions that are within these three areas of planning, self-control, and monitoring. But I think when you see that, you'll see how many of our folks are having some challenges around that. So when we think about the reptile brain and what's going on in terms of that fight, flight, or freeze idea, there's a ton of research out there about the vagus nerve and the polyvagal system, which basically is showing us that when we're in sort of a calm, safe, I feel good, I feel emotionally safe, socially safe, and physically safe in this situation, I can engage. I can be curious. I can be open. I feel, you know, kind of settled. Let's have this calm conversation about what I want to do, where I want to go, and so forth. What can start to happen, of course, is that we can start to get activated with our fears. If I start feeling judged by you, I start to feel socially unsafe. If I am in my own head about what a terrible person I am, I start to feel emotionally unsafe. If I have a history of trauma where, you know, loud noises or people being too close to me or whatever have been dangerous or threatening to me, I'm not going to feel safe. What's going to start to happen then is it's going to trigger my fight, flight, kind of response. I'm either going to be mad at you and directing stuff out at you, or I'm going to run away. I'm going to get out of here. And a lot of times what ends up happening is people move on up into the freeze mode, where now I'm just kind of collapsed. I'm just sitting there. I have no ability to engage one way or another. You can just kind of see that I'm shut down, disassociating. Yes, okay, yes, I'll do that. And that whole freeze response, you know, kind of keeps people in inertia. Part of what we need to understand is, one, this can happen, you know, in any individual engagement with people, but a lot of what I think is going on is we're seeing more and more people who are existing constantly or almost constantly in fight, flight, or freeze. As they're going through this experience of unemployment, depending on their own individual histories, they may be in a permanent state of fight, flight, or freeze, which makes it very difficult for them to be in this calm, safe, socially engaged kind of mode. And so part of what we're looking at is having to really pay attention to what are we doing to consistently monitor where people are at, and how do we help them feel safe, feel grounded, and so forth. Now, the other thing I want to say is, this is true for everyone. This is not just the job seekers that we are working with. We can have job seekers send us into fight, flight, or freeze through our interactions. And in fact, we can get into this thing where we're setting each other off, because if they're questioning my advice, I start thinking, well, I'm not stupid. I need to, you know, prove to them that I'm not stupid. I know what I'm talking about. So we get into, you know, fight kind of situation. They keep fighting back. Maybe we freeze. I give up. Okay, you go do whatever you want. We are both in this. We both have to pay attention to, am I feeling safe? If I'm not feeling engaged and socially connected down here at the bottom, the first question I have to ask myself is, what's happening inside? Am I in fight, flight, or freeze? Am I feeling triggered, activated, unsafe in some way in this conversation? How can I help myself calm down, help myself calm that vagal nerve? And how then might I also help the other person that I'm working with calm down and calm that nerve? Because it is happening outside. It's not something that you can think your way out of. You have to, you know, do some things. Breathing is a great one. That help you sort of calm it. Taking 30 seconds. Let's breathe. Let's come back into this. I'm feeling a little, you know, activated by this or whatever. And then we can get to a calmer place. This, I think, is just a great chart for kind of, oh, yeah, go ahead, Lisa.
I was just going to say, you asked a question, and then you continued to talk.
Oh, sorry, I'm really good at that.
I thought it might be an interesting question to ask the group. And Amy, do you remember what it was? Something about, well, what do you do, if you go back to that slide, what are you doing with the clients that are in that, you know, fight, flight? You had said, what are people doing with clients that are in that area? I think something like that. Do you remember the question?
I think how are people notice? Are we noticing that? How are we dealing it with it when we are noticing it? Are we noticing it about ourselves?
Yeah, I think that's the critical question that you were getting. So that's what I took away was this, this mutuality of this experience is really, really powerful. And you're saying that this is really about both parties engaging in this process and how we can model some of that if we are experiencing it ourselves. I mean, that's what I took away from that. Is that what you're...
Yeah, and I would... And one of the things that we know, and I'm going to talk about trauma and its impact on this, one of the things that we know is that a lot of people who are attracted to helping professions have a history of their own trauma. And we're doing it to master trauma and so forth. We often are the ones that are going to be likely to get triggered too if we haven't done some of our own work around these issues. And I know, speaking for myself, as an example, one of the things that I started to observe in myself is the number of times I would get angry with people for not taking my advice. But what I realized was happening was they were coming in and feeling unsafe and unsure. And their way of, you know, dealing with that was to be irritable with me, to push back on me, because they're also not very nice about it. You know, they're not gently pushing back. You know, they're basically like, you know, this never works and coming at me. And then that was, you know, sending me higher, you know, and then I would, and we've talked about this even with our job fairs, then I want to get away from them. Then it feels like, what can I say to shut you up, to get you to go away? Because now I am feeling so stressed, I can't deal with you anymore. Right. And then, of course, they take that as rejection.
So I want to stop the conversation and see what other people are thinking about this and how they get out of this situation, if they realize it, what they've done, how they manage it, if it's something they can relate to.
Right. Lisa, if I could reframe the question a little bit, I think you're right. I think we do want to hear from other people about what, because this is a pretty powerful thing you're bringing up, Michelle. So maybe it's not necessarily how do you solve it, because that's what we're all here to figure out.
Right.
Helping us with that. But just the first question is, when Michelle is identifying this, and I'm confirming that this feels like it's a mutually kind of not always positive kind of process. Can other people relate to that? What are your reactions or thoughts to that idea? Can people respond to that? Do people have thoughts? People want to put it in the chat box or comment? You've let everybody unmute, Lisa?
I did.
Okay.
Let's hear from Detroit. You've got four people there. What do you got?
I have to put you on the spot. But
it sounds like psychotherapy to me. You know, I'm telling you, I'm a social worker. It's the countertransference. And usually in the countertransference is about, you know, a family member that drives you crazy. And that's who the person reminds you of, and you have to deal with it on your own. There's something going on with, I guess, vocational counselors too. So Detroit, tell us something.
Well, I'm this is Debbie from Detroit, and I was thinking about a couple of our really challenging clients that walk in the door already kind of agitated. So they're in probably somewhere between flight and freeze in terms of response. We haven't even said anything yet. We haven't done anything. And it's very hard to not take the bait when they start being adversarial with you. You can say anything to them, from "How are you doing today?" And they will launch right into that. What does help is to try to do some grounding, I think, with them. But it is really hard to do. I mean, you just have to be super conscious. I'm thinking about someone recently that I talked to over the phone, and the whole time I was saying to myself, don't take the bait, don't take the bait, because that's what she wanted me to do to get into this confrontational situation, and that wasn't going to be helpful to her. And it certainly wouldn't have felt good to me either. So, but it's hard to do. When clients are reactivated, they use us sometimes as really kind of a safe load also. But yeah, it is about validating them and all of that. But it's a little easier said than done.
So it sounds like you're very intentional, that you really think about it, so that you don't take the bait, that you stay grounded. That's how you're dealing with this situation that they're talking about.
Yeah.
Anyone else have any thoughts about this? Okay. I love that chart. I'm going to send it to my daughter. I think it's super interesting.
Yeah, there's actually some work that I, so there's an excellent book called The Body Keeps the Score that talks about the fact that, again, trauma and experiences of trauma and so forth, and the things that tend to send us into fight, flight, and freeze are actually, we have to do body work, not just talk work, not just thinking work, in order to be able to really engage with that and release that. And there's some work called somatic experiencing that really helps people get in touch with what is the physical experience of being in fight, flight, or freeze. What things do I need to release from my nervous system? Because it really comes down to, the nervous system has been activated. How do I let it work its way through my nervous system? Because if you look, animals don't have trauma, because animals are able to, they get, you know, they're chased, let's say, by a lion, and the deer actually is able to complete a nervous system response that includes panting, sweating, shaking, all of these very physical kinds of things that they're able to complete, and so that it doesn't get embedded in their bodies. Human beings don't have that, and we often have to pretend to be some other way or move on to the next, you know, situation or whatever. And so I part of what I want to get across is this is a very physical experience, and a big way that we end up having to work with it is understanding it as a physical experience and understanding how it is embedded in our physical selves. And part of the reason that we end up getting, you know, activated with, you can see they've already come in activated and then we're trying not to respond, is because we have mirror neurons in our brains that try to put us in synchronicity with a person that we are dealing with. And this is asking us to not do that. It is asking us to be in a different state so we can bring them down to us and into a more calmer thing, as opposed to having them carry us into their activated state. Also, honestly, most of us are working in work environments that are not exactly designed to keep you down in this calm area. There's a lot of stuff that can be going on at work with peers, with your boss, with everything, and that becomes cumulative. And you can carry that with you so that you may already be, they may come in, you know, up here, but you may be down here. And already kind of operating in the yellow zone as opposed to the red zone. And so that, you know, paying attention all day to how we get back down into that calm nervous system mode is a thing.
I want to make a comment about this because I think it can feel this whole thing is so incredibly important in how we do our work, and also kind of intense, kind of what you were saying in Detroit about, you know, this is, just how you, you really have to be so diligent about it. And so I guess what I want to say, given that we only have about 15 minutes left, is that it's so incredible, Michelle, and I think so pivotal to the work, but I don't want people to feel fearful about not getting it all in this call, I guess is what I'm saying. That this is, we're really introducing this, and this is going to be an ongoing dialogue, and, you know, of course, Michelle, we may have you back for more conversations about this, but, you know, this is really introducing something that's really important, and that we have to, now we're getting it, we're being introduced to it, we're paying attention to it, we're thinking about it, we're talking about it, and this is the beginning of a longer dialogue, I guess is what I want to just say. And I also want to do a time check, Michelle, because do you think in terms of what you have left, we'll have time, given we have to wrap up and have some time at the end?
Yes, let me move into, there are a couple of things, other things I quickly wanted to cover, and then I think, so I will send these slides so people can, you know, access the slides. I also want to say, this is stuff we're at the beginning of really looking at, how do we incorporate this into what we're doing. So I would love to open dialogue with folks about how to do this. This is half about how does it inform my own personal practice of how I work with folks, because I want to make a difference, and sometimes it feels like we're not making as much of a difference as I would like. Yeah. So I mentioned also this idea then that, you know, certainly we have to look at how we're engaging that safety mechanism, and that is just so key. We can't do anything else until people feel reasonably safe, and we have that emotional part of the brain. The other piece then is these executive skills, the executive function skills. And in order for folks to be able to make plans, execute on their plans, and so forth, they need to have skills in three main areas: planning, self-control, and monitoring. But these are specific skills within that, like the ability to prioritize what is important and what is not important. I see this all the time with our folks. Everything's of equal importance. The ability to sustain attention. People are very distractible, and they create environments that cause even more distraction. So how do we be focused on, I'm going to be focused on this one thing, because multitasking is, you know, a lie. We don't do that. Understanding also that working memory, metacognition, thinking about thinking, being flexible, these are also executive function skills. Two points I want to make is, one, they are skills, which means that you can learn them, you can improve them. Two, there are ways that technology and other kinds of things can support us. So one of the things I talk about is, I used to have a great memory for all the tasks on my list, and my working memory was good, but now I need to do to-do lists in order to make sure that I keep up with everything, because if I don't, then I don't. And so we can look at ways to support executive function. There is a process called Goal, Plan, Do, Review, Revise that we are taking a very close look at, that is specifically around how do we do support executive function in workforce and career programming. And so it's something that I think we need to be looking at more closely, and really thinking about how do we improve people's skills in these different areas. And then the third piece, all of this related, is we are also looking at trauma. And some of you may be familiar with the idea of trauma-informed care. Certainly I'm seeing more of it in human services and in programs that serve young people, but I am increasingly of the mind that it's something that is also impacting, well, for sure it's impacting adults. I also am seeing that unemployment itself starts, especially long-term unemployment, starts to become its own form of trauma. And there are all these different experiences that people have of rejection, isolation, and so forth that just add to the trauma. And then considering whatever their history may be, this also can impact executive function and also contribute to people feeling unsafe and really activating that nervous system. And so we're looking into how do we start to bring in a trauma-informed approach, trauma-informed programming. There is definitely, in fact, I'll send the link to this to you, Amy, but a report just came out the other day about, I think it's New Hampshire, where they're doing trauma-informed in TANF. And so how do you incorporate this? One of the key things to understand, though, is your work culture has to change. Not just how you treat job seekers, the entire culture, the way peers and colleagues interact, how we interact with supervisors, everything else, has to be informed by this approach. You can't do it as a Band-Aid, but it's something that we're also starting to take a look at and really think about. How do we address these issues of the impact that trauma has on people's sense of safety and therefore their ability to hear information, but also on their executive function?
So we're actually, one of our workshops is on that, how to create a trauma-informed care workplace.
Wonderful.
Yeah, for our annual.
Yeah. It's a commitment. You have to make a real commitment to it because it is diametrically opposed to most of the ways that we operate, I think.
Agencies that are presenting on that. It's person-centered trauma-informed care for agencies and communities.
Yep.
AFCS Gulf Coast, JFS Kansas City, JEVS. Gary, are you from JEVS? And JFNA, Jewish Federations of North America, are all presenting on that.
Well, one of the things that I do want to put out there is I don't think this is just for children and young people. I don't think this is just for poor people. Because one thing I am observing is that it is tending to be in, certain communities, this is more popping up. I am making the argument that this is culture-wide, that this is something that is happening regardless of socioeconomic class, race, gender. I mean, how you experience it may be different. There are certainly different factors that come into play, but I do think we have to expand our thinking from it just being something that we need to do for TANF recipients, for example, or for, young people, and recognize, I'm telling you, I see this with our job seekers all the time, and they are, they're the opposite of a TANF person, or what our ideas of TANF recipients are. Just kind of in summary, we are really looking at how do we get people out of that advising consulting role into more of a coaching kind of role. One thing I'm going to put out there is we did start a coaching community of practice where we're trying to bring together all the people in New Jersey. So the people who are in New Jersey here, please join. But your others are welcome to join too. It's an online community practice where we're trying to start having these kinds of conversations about how do we shift from being advisors and instructors into coaching, where we're asking questions. We're definitely also looking at how do we do trauma-informed career coaching. I want to also mention a great book called Trauma Stewardship, which talks about secondary trauma. And how do we, as people who are working with folks who are in challenging situations and experiencing trauma, how are we taking care of ourselves? How are we engaging with our work in ways that are sustainable and are not causing burnout? How are we having conversations about the impact that burnout has on our ability to work with people? And so that is also something that I really am curious about and want to take a look at. We're looking at the executive function coaching. And we're also thinking about how can we use technology to both support the executive function stuff. So that's part of what we're thinking about with the digital coach. How can it help people prioritize and keep track of things and all of that? But also, how can it convey empathy and affirmation? I know we always talk about how like only people have empathy. That's not true. We can actually make machines in some ways more empathetic in that they are not judgmental. They are able to say, I hear you, I understand, tell me more, in ways that people that experience that start talking to and start feeling like, oh, I'm not being judged. Oh, I'm not, you know, no one's looking at me and thinking, why didn't you, you know, take my advice and that kind of thing. So we're also thinking about how does technology convey that empathy and affirmation that people need as well. The end. Lots of questions, lots of things that, you know, we're thinking about in the beginning stages of, you know, kind of exploring and looking at how we can incorporate.
This is amazing. I mean, this is amazing information. I tried, didn't do it too successfully to put two of the books that you mentioned into the chat box. Sorry about the misspellings there.
That's okay, I'll send them. I can send that too.
Right, great, thank you. We have a couple minutes for questions, follow-up, and then we'll wrap it. Anybody want to have some thoughts, comments, reactions?
Well, I can say Gary has a good reaction. He says, how can we rewatch this with our colleagues on tape via the website? You can't watch it, but you can listen to it. Again, we don't have enough bandwidth on our website to have all the video, but we have the... we'll have the recording and we'll have the PowerPoint. So that will help you.
Yeah, take this to the streets.
Yeah, so what about anyone else? Anyone have any thoughts before we end? Anything to say to Michelle? Anything to say to Amy?
I have some thoughts because I feel like, you know, we do have all these clients who are giving pushback because you're overwhelming them with information. But on the other hand, being where we are and trying to help them within an environment, especially a nonprofit environment, where our superiors are telling us that get them to where they have to go and get this information in a shorter period of time. But if we had the luxury to spend hours and hours making them feeling safe and comfortable, what I often do at the end of an appointment is gauge how much I've overwhelmed somebody, because I know that in an hour or even an hour and a half, which is a long session, and I have, thank God, the ability to give them an hour and a half, I'm giving them a hell of a lot of information, but I have to get that to them, because especially for the ones who haven't job searched in 20 years, they don't know how to do any of this stuff. So I'll step back and I'll say, I can see on your face that I've totally overwhelmed you. And let's talk about that. And then let's talk about how to break that down. But I think for us as counselors, coaches, whatever you want to call us, that we're constantly trying to juggle those two things between really having to help them as quickly as possible in our nonprofit environment and then giving them the space to not feel even more traumatized by all the information. So I guess I assume with your research going forward, this is what we need to look at, is how do we do that? Because that's my biggest problem.
Yeah, and I hear you on that time issue because, I mean, that is absolutely a factor. And we've been thinking about some different things. One of them is I do think that that issue of people wanting to tell their story and be heard, and if they don't feel like their story has been heard, then they also are in that fight flight, can't take in information mode. So we've been thinking about what are some different ways that we might be able to respond to that need to tell their story. And that might be something that we do in a group situation, you know, where they're able to tell and share their stories with each other, maybe where there's a facilitator who can kind of shape it a little bit, but you know, having them be able to tell it and feel really seen and heard is a thing. I also wonder if, you know, us saying like, okay, this first session is just about me really understanding what your experience has been, what have you done with your search so far, how's that been, you know, all of those kinds of things, and putting together questions that draw out a story from them, so that they do feel heard. We're also using, although not all my coaches do it, I think the coaches that do feel better about it, we are asking them to do pre-session forms that ask some really open-ended kinds of questions, not like workforce kinds of questions, like what barriers do you face, but some other kinds of questions that can also be an avenue into, let me hear you, let me, you know, kind of see what's going on with you.
Yeah, because, yeah, I think that would be a really good thing, because what I'm hearing from my board is, why are you spending so much time with them?
So can I?
Time is money, you know? Right.
So yeah. I just want to make a quick comment related to that, Meryl, which is, I think that's also the poll that I think maybe, and this is a lot of pressure, but I think to all that Michelle spoke to us about today, we now have a PowerPoint, we now have a recording, you know, take it into those board meetings and have them listen to this a little bit and get a little bit of an insight. Maybe they'll shift a little bit of their thinking, but I you know, I know that's wishful thinking. I know, but, we have an opportunity here, right. And I hope, you know, if we can make a little bit of an impression, maybe. Go ahead, Michelle.
And I do think it goes back to, so if we look at the slide that I did on, comment formed, one of the things they talk about is peer support. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we do the most effective job of really thinking about how we can co-construct peer support in ways that could supplement and complement what we as professional staff can do. Mm-hmm. And I think we could achieve a lot if we got more thoughtful and intentional about ways that we could have people running peer groups in some more effective ways, you know, because certainly there are some people who are at a better state of functioning than others who might be able to help facilitate. But I personally think we do too much one-on-one in things that we don't need to do one-on-one in, and we're not making the kind of use of co-created collaborative peer group settings that could actually do a lot in the same period of time. I could do a 3-hour, really well thought out, facilitated group session and serve 10 or 15 people, and that's going to be more than I would have done one-on-one, and I likely will get more, they will get more from it if it's well thought out.
Yeah,
I think you're right.
But we often, the time factor ends up being like, this, we already know what we do, this is the process, this is how it takes time to back up. Takes time to say, let's try to think about this strategically, let's try to plan something, let's try to put something together, see how it works. All of that takes time, and we're so in the crisis of the moment, keep going kind of thing, it becomes hard to find the space for thinking differently.
Well, I'd like to say that if anyone here has any of those kinds of trainings or ideas, you can send them to me, and I can put them in the resource library and people can look at them to see how other agencies have done these kinds of peer programs and groups. And I was just going to say, Amy, we have to end. You're presenting something at the conference too about peer-led, peer-led supervision, I think is what you're
saying. It's a little bit different, but I think this is a good segue into wrapping up and saying, Michelle, I think we could use you to come back and do a little bit more of this. So thank you very, very much.
This helped me put some thoughts together too. So thank you.
Good. So I just want to note that in the chat box, Divya has asked for any resources or recommendations to support clients with ADHD and executive function issues. So if people have thoughts about that, you can share them with me or Lisa, and we can get them out to people.
We'll put them on the website.
We'll make sure we respond to that. But this was fabulous, Michelle. Thank you. You did not disappoint. You kept up to your high expectations.
All right.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Let me just wrap up by saying thank you all for your participation and attending and giving the feedback, and invite you to, number one, the conference that's happening in May. We will be meeting before that. The NJHSA conference, Convene, Connect, Collaborate, May 3rd through 5th. We hope you can make it to Dallas for more conversations together. And our Workforce Development Affinity Group will be able to meet and chat there. And to let you know that our next program for our calls will be on,
March 18th.
Thank you, March 18th, where we're going to have Elizabeth White speaking about some of her work She is the author of 55, Underemployed and Faking Normal. Michelle, I know you know her work. And and she will, we're going to be doing a little bit of a different kind of a format in that I'm going to be framing some questions based on her work, and then she'll be responding to them. So it'll be more like a, you know, a chat where she can, she'll be sharing with us some of her insights based on the book, based on her work. She has done some really interesting work. She has a TED Talk if you want to try to find that. We'll send that out again. And thank you again. We did go over a little bit, but we really appreciate everybody participating. And thank you very much.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Hope to see you at the conference.
Yeah.
Bye.
Take care.